From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Weird weather and climate change. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. For years, scientists have predicted that global warming would lead to extreme weather, and sure enough, extremes have become what some call the new normal. But scientists have a hard time saying that a given weather event is evidence of climate change. What's overlooked is they also have trouble saying it's not. In any case, special interests seize on scientific uncertainty to avoid regulation of greenhouse gas emissions, and the public is very confused. Is the real hoax climate change, or the denial of climate change? We'll look at an issue that's become as political as it is scientific. On Reporter's Notebook later on, Turkey's election, secularism and Islam. First the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Extreme weather has become almost commonplace in the past few years in the U.S. and around the world, but Americans are increasingly doubtful about climate change caused by human activity. We'll look at the science today and the politics. On Reporter's Notebook, despite yesterday's re-election, Turkey's prime minister says he'll be humble in his next term. We'll hear why he'll need to be. First, this news update. Wall Street may not be popular with voters, especially Democrats, but it's a major force in American politics, and it could be crucial to the re-election campaign of a president who's trying to make up with the financial industry he once referred to as fat cats. Nicholas Confessori reports for The New York Times. Always good to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren. Good to be here.
What has the Obama campaign been doing in the past few weeks now to reestablish its ties with Wall Street?
It's really this kind of slow courtship that began in the weeks before he formally announced his reelection campaign. He had a bunch of financial industry folks at the White House to talk about policy. It was not a fundraiser. It was talking about policy issues, hedge fund regs, taxes. But the point was to sort of just start a conversation with these folks on the merits and give him a chance to meet and greet with some of his kind of core supporters, people who like him and know him on Wall Street. And they've been building out from there with a series of fundraisers, meetings with campaign officials, Jim Messina, Patrick Gaspard at the DNC, and it's going to culminate at this big, glitzy fundraiser at a fancy restaurant on the Upper East Side this month.
That'll be this month. Now, to what extent is he telling Wall Street that his policies are going to reflect their interests?
Well, you know, it's really a delicate dance for him, right? He wants to both, kind of stake his claim to the issues where he has a difference with them on regulation, on taxes, on the hedge fund carried interest proposal. But he also wants to persuade them, I think, that if they are healthy, if their businesses are healthy, if they're making money, it's partly because of the bailout that he pushed through. It's partly because of the broader policies of the administration on economic growth. So he doesn't want to seem like he's listening to them too much, but he wants to create the sense that there is an open door, and he wants to sort of fight and argue for his policies on their merits and make the point that he thinks he has helped them on the merits.
Why are they so mad at him? Plenty of presidents have called them fat cats, and it hasn't seemed to bother them very much.
Well, the truth is, I think some of these guys have strong policy differences with the president. There are a lot of folks on Wall Street who just can't stand to pay taxes and hate the idea of high taxes on their businesses, who don't want a tighter rules on how they do business because they believe it'll hurt them in the marketplace. But there are plenty of people who also support him and agree with him, I think. The question is, is the rhetoric from 2009, 2010, which has pretty much subsided, is that really going to have a lasting impact on the mood of these people?
If he's going to have a campaign war chest of $1 billion, which is what people have been talking about, how much of it is going to have to come from Wall Street?
Well, Wall Street was a huge and generous supporter of the president last time. He raised a lot more than John McCain. And Wall Street traditionally actually has been a great source of strength for Democratic fundraising. I couldn't tell you what percentage they're counting on, but certainly people who work on Wall Street, people who work at banks, hedge funds, are important both to the basic fundraising, but you also got to remember, you know, in 2012, you're going to have these independent expenditures, right? Huge amounts of money spent on ads, you know, outside organizations, not coordinating with the campaigns, but sort of helping or hurting the different candidates. And the guys who fund those organizations are the kind of folks who can write checks on a dime for $10 million. And those tend to be rich guys, and a lot of them work on Wall Street.
What did they do in 2010?
Who?
Wall Street.
Wall Street supported, you know, turned around a lot, right? In 2010, a lot of people, you know, especially hedge fund folks, turned around and supported Republicans, especially in those congressional races. Some folks who had contributed to the president actually wrote large checks to groups that spent money in support of Republican candidates in 2010. So you saw the beginnings of a flip in the congressional races, and the real question now is that trend going to continue, or is it going to, you know, abate, and is the president going to win back some of those donors?
Does it make the liberal base of the Democratic Party uncomfortable when their president is wooing Wall Street to the extent that this one is?
It probably does. You know, there's the appearance of closeness, which probably angers some people. But as I said, I think the administration is trying to walk this fine line of having an open dialogue with Wall Street and the rest of the business community, frankly. There's a whole program of business outreach, talking about jobs, talking about growth, but without giving the sense or the reality that they are, you know, cutting any slack to Wall Street. And, of course, it's all in the eye of the beholder.
Of course, his new chief of staff, William Daley, comes from a banking community. So does the Secretary of State, Tim Geithner.
That's correct. Well, you know, Wall Street has often been a source of talent and hires for White Houses on both sides of the spectrum.
Nicholas Confessori with the New York Times. As always, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
In a moment, weird weather and climate change on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. This year and the past decade have seen an increase in human catastrophes caused by unusual weather of different kinds. Arizona's wildfires right now are the result of a drought, while late snow in the western mountains has led to predictions of massive flooding. These are the kinds of things that climate change scientists have predicted. But public skepticism that it's caused by, or they are caused by, human activity is on the increase, and efforts in Washington to take any action are on the decline. Elizabeth Colbert covers the environment for The New Yorker magazine. Thanks very much for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
Remind our listeners, if you will, about the decade between the 2000 and 2010 and the kind of weather a phenomenon we saw that seemed to be so surprising to people in various parts of the world.
Well, the first thing I should mention is just it's been a very, very warm decade, the warmest decade on record. And if you go online and look up the 10 warmest years on record, you will find that they have all occurred since 1998. Last year, in fact, globally was the warmest year on record. So we'll just sort of start by laying that groundwork because that's pretty significant.
Sure.
Now, some of the things that, you know, really extreme, you know, what are often called extreme weather events that we've seen during that decade, one very extreme event was the 2003 heat wave in Europe that killed tens of thousands of people, actually. Last summer, we saw tremendous flooding in Pakistan, which people will probably remember seeing the photos of that. We saw a tremendous heat wave in Russia that sent temperatures up to record levels and led to forest fires outside Moscow that blanketed the city in smoke that cut the country's wheat harvest. So those are some of the highlights we've seen, record flooding along the Mississippi in our own country a couple times now this decade, the 100-year flood, people saying, you know, now becoming basically the once every 10-year flood.
Why is it so hard for a scientist to make a connection between these events, which they predicted, and the idea that climate change is caused by human activity?
Well, you know, this is a kind of interesting and very profound sort of misunderstanding that just goes on and on and on. And it's basically just a statistical question, right? So any given hurricane, let's say, or fierce storm or heat wave or drought or flood, that's sort of a weather event. So that has a lot of, the weather is a chaotic system. It has a lot of randomness to it. So any given event, it's very, very difficult, in fact, almost impossible to say this event happened because of climate change. But the point that climate scientists would make is we are basically loading the dice, right? So if every event is random the same way every time you throw the dice, that should be random if your dice aren't loaded. We are now loading the dice so that it becomes more and more likely that you get a hot year, that you get a heat wave, that you get an intense drought. And when we look over the broad statistics globally going back over time, we do in fact see these changes in precipitation that were predicted.
So nonetheless, as you say, when it depends on statistical questions, and when scientists can't say, yes, this particular event is caused by climate change, then people can seize on that and say, well, maybe climate change doesn't exist after all.
Yes, exactly. And that's just unfortunately having the conversation in the wrong place. We're just discussing the wrong issues. We have a tremendous amount, whether we know whether this particular event or not was caused by climate change, we know that the broad pattern is related to climate change. And we also know, which should be even more sobering, that climate change has a tremendous time lag in the system. So we are only now seeing the effects, basically, of carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, that were put up into the atmosphere decades ago. And we continue to put CO2 into the air. And so every year we are basically, to go back to the metaphor of loading the dice, we are loading them more and more, and we're loading them for our kids, basically.
And we are doing less and less about it.
Absolutely. The trend lines we just got the same week, you know, basically virtually the same week that the president went out to Joplin, which had been destroyed by these really intense tornadoes, which may or may not, once again, have been the result of global warming because of what we just talked about. The International Energy Agency released its compilation of what CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, were like for 2010. And despite an economic slowdown globally, which you would maybe think had brought CO2 emissions down, in fact, they went up by a record amount. So all of those signals are going in the wrong direction.
Again, Elizabeth Colbert, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. We'll come back, talk to you some more in a moment. First, I want to introduce Anthony Lazarowitz, who is a director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication and a research scientist at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about where public opinion is going on this issue.
Well, over the past 2 years, we've seen a pretty dramatic decline in public opinion. But I would say in the past year, it's basically stabilized. And it's even perhaps started to bounce back just a little bit. But basically, we're off probably about 9 to 10 points in terms of public belief and concern than where we were in the fall of 2008.
When was it then? Or what was the measurement then?
Well, for example, in the fall of 2008, we had 71% of Americans who said that global warming was happening. As of just a couple of weeks ago, it was 64%.
What about whether global warming is, in fact, the result of CO2 emissions caused by human activity?
So there we found that in the fall of 2008, 57% of Americans said that global warming was caused mostly by human activities. That's now down to 47%, so a 10-point drop.
Now, how do you account for that drop? What do you think caused it?
Well, there's a variety of things that are going on here, and I should also say that there's been drops in public levels of worry and so on. And I'd point out just a few major factors. First of all, the economy. The economy soared to the top of public priorities with very good reason as the housing bubble burst and people began to lose their jobs. And so climate change and a lot of other issues just dropped in public priority and in worry. Secondly, media coverage. My colleagues traced media coverage, and we found that newspaper coverage has dropped to less than one-third of what it was in 2007, and network nightly news coverage has dropped to less than one-fifth of what it was in 2007. And because most people only learn about this issue through the media, they don't see it, they don't know scientists, they don't read the peer-reviewed literature, when the media doesn't report this issue, it's literally out of sight and out of mind. We've also seen, of course, two unusual cold winters. So I think this year was Snowpocalypse and the year before was Snowmageddon. And there are some people who don't know very much about climate change who interpret those, you know, snowy and cold events as somehow evidence that climate change isn't existing. And then last but not least, of course, we have a very organized denial movement, a set of institutions and people who are basically doing everything they can to cast doubt on the science itself.
And who are those people?
Well, there are typically a range of right-wing conservative think tanks, as well as some of the major players in the fossil fuel industry, some of the world's largest companies that continue to profit mightily on the fossil fuel-based energy system.
Anthony Lazarowitz at Yale, where he studies climate change communication. Back to Elizabeth Colbert with the New Yorker magazine. How is it that you can have cold winters in the middle of what's supposed to be the increased global temperatures?
Well, some people have, as Anthony said, you're always going to get people saying that is proof that you're not getting global climate change. What you have to look at for global warming, there's a reason why it's called global warming, are average global temperatures. And we in the Northeast and maybe even across the U.S. had a pretty cold record, once again, not a record-breaking cold winter, but a pretty cold winter this winter. But if you looked up in the Arctic, it was a phenomenally warm winter. So once again, if you average these global temperatures out, you see that not every year, but practically every year now, we are getting into the 10 warmest years on record. So you can't look at the weather the same way. You can't look at one storm. You cannot look at the weather in one part of the world and say, oh, this just proves this theory. If we started to get, a very long string of globally cool winters, we could start to talk. But a winter or two of locally cold weather really doesn't. It just means you have a change in weather patterns.
But isn't snow precipitation? And isn't there a theory that when the climate in general warms, there's more water In the atmosphere, and therefore precipitation is more likely in many forms?
Yes. I mean, the snowfall, there are sort of two issues. One, just temperatures, and then snowfall. And it was, once again, a snowy winter, not this past winter in some parts of the country. And there are some arguments that since warm air holds more moisture, you would actually expect more snow in certain parts of the country. But once again, that's a pretty random thing. We don't have a lot of years of data of, greater snowfall, let's say, in the Northeast. So I wouldn't want to pin that on climate change at this point. And I don't think that most climate scientists would pin that on climate change at this point. We just don't know about that. The really robust signal of global warming is that you are getting globally higher temperatures.
Anthony Lazarowitz, back to you. An interesting question has recently been asked that wasn't raised before, and that is, what percentage of Americans think that there's a consensus among scientists about the threat from global warming?
Well, as of just a couple of weeks ago, it was 39% said that most scientists believe that climate change is happening. But we followed that up with a subsequent question that asked them to estimate what proportion of climate scientists think it's happening, to actually give us a number. And what we found is that only 13% of Americans got the correct answer, which was 81 to 100% of scientists. In fact, a number of studies have found that it's about 97% of climate scientists agree that climate change is happening, while a good 31% of the public says that they don't even know. So there's still a lot of misunderstanding about the degree of agreement among the scientific community.
So back to media, then, that would suggest that the major source of information for people on this subject, that the news media have not really been reporting what scientists think.
In part. I mean, I would actually say that it's actually just as much about signal to noise ratio, as in there's just not that much coverage of climate change. I mean, notwithstanding the fabulous coverage by Elizabeth and a number of other great reporters, this story is just a very small, tiny little news item compared to the many other things that the media reports. So I think, by and large, most people just don't learn much about this issue, period. And then you throw into that the fact that there is a very organized movement out there to try to cast doubt on the science, and they've certainly had an impact.
Richard Root is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Michigan. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
How concerned are you about what we've been hearing so far on this program, that 97% of scientists think that global warming is real, that human behavior is the major contributor to it, and yet the public is so ill-informed?
So my concern is the following, which is that I have no doubt that the scientific community, especially those expert in climate science, you know, are in a vast supermajority feeling that the science is valid, that the planet is warming, that it can be attributed to humans. One of the things that concerns me is the role of doubt and the industry or the effort to not only to create doubt but to use that doubt to erode not only the public, let's say the public support of doing something about climate change, but they also, you know, use that doubt to, I think, undermine the credibility of the science.
In what ways do they do that? How does it affect the media coverage?
So, you know, I think that there's a possibility even for well-intentioned scientists to participate in the building of doubt. Earlier on, it was mentioned the article about the Russian heat wave, or the Russian heat wave of last year. And back in March and April, there were a series of papers that came out trying to make this categorization of whether or not it was natural or anthropogenic. And that was followed then by a set of blogs, some of which were by some very prominent scientists, who started to, let's say, make very critical remarks about the methodologies that were used in those studies. And these sorts of studies actually got picked up quite quickly by those who like to propagate the doubt. And so these arguments that maybe 15 or 20 years ago would have taken place in, you know, scientific journals and perhaps with sort of slow rumination become a significant issue.
Hold that thought, Richard Rood, with the University of Michigan. We'll be back with you and with our other guests as well. We'll add a couple more as well after we take a very brief break on Reporter's Notebook. A bit later, Turkey's election, secularism and Islam. You can join the conversation on our To the Point Facebook, too. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. We're talking today about climate change and the creation of doubt about climate change. Also the relationship of climate change to the weather patterns that people observe, which are the what they regard as the most obvious evidence one way or the other. We're talking now with Richard Rood, atmospheric scientist at the University of Michigan, and you made this distinction, or you said that there is always raised a distinction between what's happening naturally and what's happening anthropogenically, meaning that human beings are the cause of it. You've said that that is a false distinction. Why is it a false distinction?
I think it's a false distinction because it places a scientist into the idea that there are two climates, one natural and one human caused, and that there's an event that we can attribute to one or the others. Whereas in fact, in atmospheric science and climate science and natural science, we really only have, you know, one experiment. We have what we have. And so what we're seeing is an evolving climate, And when we start to look at these events, what we're seeing is, you know, those events evolving and unfolding in this warming climate, in this more moist climate. So I think it's an important role of the scientist to actually participate in the dialogue, to not continue to propagate this idea that there is a natural and then an unnatural or human-caused climate condition.
You said that some well-intentioned scientists often create doubt. Are you concerned about that if they participate in the dialogue?
Yes, I'm very concerned about it, because you know, they create doubt not only about the body of the science as a whole, but they also at times create doubt about the scientific method and the integrity of other scientists, you know, most of whom are very, very good scientists.
How do they do that, and how could they avoid it and still participate in the conversation?
Well, I think that one of the ways you do it is at some level you think about it. You know, if you're going to be writing, you know, a blog, and there are so many scientists writing blogs these days, if you're going to be writing a blog that is particularly questioning, you know, a paper that's, say, doing some sort of particular study, then I think it's probably better to couch that in a language that doesn't say that's wrong or those methods are invalid, but that there are a number of different approaches that are potentially productive in extracting, say, the human element of a signal of a particular event. So part of it is just, you know, sort of the simplicity of communication and language.
So don't get into academic disputes using strong language. What about the response to questions asked by reporters such as, are the Arizona wildfires or is the huge snowpack in the Sierra Nevada and other western mountains or is the switch from cold to hot on the east coast the result of global warming?
So my general response to that, let's stick just as an example to the snowpack in the Sierra, is that there is a lot of natural variability, and indeed one of the facts of global warming is that the air is warmer, it holds more moisture, and so when it does snow, the probability of it snowing a lot more is higher. And so the way I generally extend that argument when I'm lecturing to my students is let's start to look at a number of events and are they correlated in some way or another? And, you know, meaning are they related to each other in some sort of consistent way that you can start to see the emergence of this idea of a warmer, moisture climate.
Richard Root, again, an atmospheric scientist at the University of Michigan. Some people are getting very impatient about the failure of the government to deal with this issue. Bill McKibben is one of them. He's founder of the Global Climate Campaign, 350.org, and he's a distinguished scholar at Middlebury College in Vermont. Professor McKibben, good to have you on our program.
Well, good to be with you.
What do you want to do about this, or what do you think ought to be done about it, not just by politicians at the moment, but by ordinary citizens?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I wrote the first book about climate change 22 years ago. We basically knew what we needed to know back then. When you burn coal and gas and oil, you put carbon in the atmosphere, the molecular structure of CO2 traps heat, the planet's going to get warmer. And indeed, the planet has been getting steadily warmer. And one of the things that's most interesting about this debate is pretty much everybody outside America realizes it. We organize at 350.org in 189 countries. We've pretty much every country in the world but North Korea. And this is the only one where there's this kind of extreme denialism and whatever underway. I mean, look at the UK. They just elected a conservative government that outdid the former Labour government in its efforts to try to deal with climate change. The thing we have to do is clear. We have to beat the fossil fuel industry and impose the cost on carbon for the damage that it's doing around us. And until we do that, we're going to just keep having this same arid discussion year after year after year. And that, you know, beating the fossil fuel industry is no easy task. Their business model is we get to put we get to use the atmosphere as an open sewer into which to dump for free our main waste product, CO2. They will defend and are defending that business model ably. We're never going to have as much money as them, so our choice is to find an alternative currency to work in, and that currency is going to have to be bodies and spirit and creativity. That's why we've built 350.org, this first big global grassroots climate campaign. We need people everywhere around the world helping out.
Especially, I gather, in the United States. What would you propose that they do?
Well, we have a whole bunch of things that people are working on right now. Clearly people can do things close to home, you know, with their light bulbs or their car, but also clearly you can't make the math work that way. We need legislative action. We're not going to get any out of this Congress, but we can really push the political movement building so that at the next possible opening, we can get the kind of laws that we need, laws that would change the price of carbon. So the next big opportunity politically for people in this country will be on September 24th. We're doing this huge global day of action called Moving Planet. There'll be a big part of it in L.A., and it'll be a big power. If it's like the last two of these global days of action we've done, CNN called them the most widespread days of political action in the planet's history. They're not going to win by one day's activism, one day's protest. This is going to be an ongoing fight because we're up against the most powerful and profitable industry in the world. But Mother Nature is going to continue to give us constant reminders of the folly that we're engaged in. Sooner or later, that's going to cause us to act. The question is, as all your guests have said already, whether it's going to be sooner or later. In this case, delay is as fateful as complete inaction, because the physics and chemistry of climate change mean we have to act fast if we want to do anything about this.
Bill McKibben at 350.org and also at Middlebury College in Vermont. Daryl Samuelson, a senior editor and energy and environment reporter for Politico. And Daryl Samuelson, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me back on.
No question tonight, the question of global warming is going to come up at the Republican debate, which for those listeners where our program comes on late in the evening will already have occurred. But for the others who are hearing it live and who will hear it before the debate itself, Mitt Romney is expected to take a lot of heat on this issue, even from Tom Pawlenty, who, while he was governor of Minnesota, took a lot of action with regard to global warming.
Yeah, Mitt Romney said something that he probably shouldn't say if you're running for the Republican presidential nomination right now, which is that he believes in climate science. He said that about 2 weeks ago in New Hampshire, and Rush Limbaugh a couple hours later said bye-bye nomination on his radio show. So clearly Mitt kind of crossed into a no man's land. It's not that far away from where the Republican Party was about 2, 3, 4 years ago when McCain was their nominee. They were in a totally different place, actually, supporting carbon caps. John McCain did as he was running against Barack Obama, and even President Bush, as he was leaving office, kind of was at a much different place than where the Republican Party has gone today. And so you're seeing, besides Mitt Romney, you're seeing from Newt Gingrich, from Tim Pawlenty, just this shift to the right as Republicans looking to try and woo the Tea Party conservatives, are pretty much saying that climate change doesn't exist and it's not a problem.
What seems to be the support for that idea? Where did it come from? How was it that the GOP, particularly serious candidates for president, were able to change so quickly?
I think it's who they're trying to appeal to, and it's a pretty partisan split when you poll it. Sometimes the conservatives don't believe in climate change that it's a problem, and the Democrats are very concerned that it's a problem. So if you're looking at polls and you're also looking at the shape of the economy, where the big response to this, of course, would have a cost. It's a question of how much of a cost. It's a pretty safe political move for a Republican to disown climate change at this point and walk away from it. I mean, it's a way to contrast with President Obama, too, who pushed, for carbon caps in the first 2 years. Some would argue how much he pushed, but he certainly pushed for them, and his EPA is regulating for greenhouse gases. And so for a Republican, it's probably smart politics to look quite different than the president on this.
Darren Samuelson with Politico. But let me go back to our first guest, Elizabeth Colbert, the staff writer for The New Yorker, who's written about the president when he was visiting one of the tornado-struck cities in Joplin, Missouri. You raised this this question of what he promised to do and what he's in fact been done. Give us a quick history.
Well, you know, as was just enumerated, the president came into office pushing, or at least espousing, that he was going to push for a so-called cap-and-trade system where you'd put a cap on total carbon emissions and you'd give out allowances and you would slowly bring that cap down. So we would eventually bring down emissions. And that he just sort of sat on the sidelines. Well, the House of Representatives actually eventually did pass a bill, a pretty weak bill by many standards, but they did pass a bill, and then it died in the Senate. And since the midterm elections, the conversation has really, really, as we see for the Republican candidates who are renouncing their own records, you know, on this issue, has shifted to this kind of absurd, you know, fact-free realm. And the president, unfortunately, has sort of partly follow that logic. You know, that's just sort of basic politics. But I think one of the interesting things, and I suppose you could say we're at a particularly low moment now. We keep seeming to hit these low moments. But the flip side of that is perhaps if there is a way, as Bill says, to build energy on the other side, that things could potentially flip the other way rather quickly. The Tea Party really, on some level, should be a model for how you can change this debate if there's a lot of energy behind it.
Let me go back to Anthony Lazarowitz, still with us, director at the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. Professor, what are the prospects for Bill McKibben or anybody else to change things back in the other direction at this point? Is there an available audience for that idea, according to your polling?
Yeah, actually, I do think so. There's a latent willingness, and I think what Elizabeth just said is right on as well, and what Bill is trying to do is exactly what's probably needed, too, and that's building an issue public. It's a segment of the American public that really is mobilized and demanding change. And yet, at the same time, you're going to need a silent majority, you know, that isn't out in the streets and mobilized demanding it, but will give their elected officials permission to act. And actually, we already see some of that out there. I mean, we have some results that we're going to release in the next day or two. We find that 71% of Americans think that global warming should be a high, very high, or medium priority for the president and Congress. And also, really interestingly, 91% of Americans think that developing sources of clean energy should be a very high or medium priority. And that's across the board. I mean, we're talking 97% of Democrats and 85% of Republicans. So around this idea of clean, renewable energy, you actually find very strong bipartisan support, not necessarily around climate change. I mean, you know, some Democrats are support it because of climate change, but some Republicans are big supporters of clean energy because they're worried about our national security, as well as the economic opportunities in developing these whole new industries. So I think there's at least the opportunity there if the elected officials want to take advantage of it.
So, Bill McKibben, this is, of course, what you're talking about, again, with the 350.org, first in September, then do you hope next year to have an impact on the presidential election and on the elections to Congress and the Senate?
I think it's, at this point, the best we can hope for. We don't know yet, and it'll depend in many ways on how this question plays out, on whether people perceive that the climate is changing and that it is a serious threat. In fact, in many ways, both a far more serious threat in the long run than the temporary damage to our economy and the possible way out, as Tony was just saying, of our economic woes. Doing something about the transition to away from fossil fuel. Look, this is never going to be easy. We are the most addicted country in the world to fossil fuel, and denial runs very deep in addicts. I mean, I used to run a homeless shelter. I knew a lot of junkies, and I, you know, see in my own life and in the you know, lives of many of us around some of that same kind of defensiveness about the world we inhabit. But we're going to have to wake up, and we're going to have to deal with it, or we're going to pay price far higher than anything we're talking about now.
Darren Samuelson, when we hear the kind of statistics we just did from Anthony Lazarowitz, Does that suggest that the Republicans just might be going down the wrong track?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, it seems like, for the time being, at least politically, you know, they're trying to speak to a certain audience, and then, you know, you get into a general election, and I'm sure whoever the candidate is probably moves back to the middle a little bit. So something to certainly watch out for once we get beyond a presidential primary to a general election. Of course, it depends on who they nominate, and if it is someone from the far right of the party versus someone who's, you know, maybe a little bit more known as a centrist, like a Mitt Romney or a Tim Pawlenty or a John Huntsman. So that's something to watch out for. But I think, you know, just after covering the congressional debate here for the last couple of years, watching that cap and trade bill die, I mean, that issue has really kind of seared its way into the minds of the Democrats. And so I think a lot of them are going to be very, you know, gun-shy to get back into another debate on this, certainly if it's called cap and trade and they're going to try many different ways to rename it or call it something different. Republicans, you know, pretty effectively, you know, called it a national energy tax. They called it cap and tax. They just basically threw the word tax in there. And that was a powerful argument. It got a lot of moderate Democrats squeamish, and a lot of them are no longer in office now. And if they were to somehow take back the House, I would imagine that, you know, if Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker again, she would need to think twice before she pushed again on this issue.
Bill McKibben, would you go as far as advocating civil disobedience?
For people who are interested in that, go to a website called climatedirectaction.org. A bunch of us are figuring out how we're going to be using those sort of traditional tools of moral witness later this year, this summer, in order to try and deal with some of these things, especially the Obama administration's decision on whether or not to permit this huge pipeline they want to run out of the tar sands of Alberta down to Texas. That's a 1,500-mile fuse to the biggest carbon bomb on the continent, and we're going to have to figure out every legal way and every peaceful and nonviolent way that there might be to stop it.
Richard Rude, back to you at the University of Michigan, atmospheric scientist there. What role do you think scientists should play? You said they should be part of the dialogue. If, in fact, things get as heated as Bill McKibben wants them to.
I think scientists participate in all roles. Some scientists choose to participate through advocacy. Some choose to participate in trying to develop, you know, the synthesis that's needed for solutions. I think that some scientists are, you know, quite politically active. I think they should take strong positions, like Bill just said, on the consequences of making energy decisions and what they mean to the climate and to climate change and the environment in general, because it's not just climate that the fossil fuel use impacts.
Are scientists slowing things down a bit, do you think, by asking for new models, by being as outspoken as they are about the uncertainties involved?
I think the way the scientists talk about uncertainty bluntly shows a little naivete of scientists in how uncertainties mix into decision-making. In the climate change problem-solving class I teach, one of the things the students learn every year is that climate change and the uncertainties associated with climate change sit in relationships to a lot of other uncertainties, and that bluntly the uncertainty associated with the physical climate part of climate change is actually quite small compared with the other types of uncertainties that they deal with. And I think this does lead to scientists you know, advocating, talking about the biggest uncertainties, and sometimes talking about the need for additional assets, which then, of course, leads to an argument over assets. And I do think that at some level or another, that does get in the way of the progress that we could and I think should be trying to make.
Very quickly, final question of Bill McKibben. Are you concerned that you might overplay your hand and that there might be a backlash to, particularly given what Darren Samuel said about the kind of language that can be thrown at this issue and the warning, especially about taxes?
On the list of things I'm worried about, global warming advocates overplaying their hand is not high on it.
we just came through the warmest year in history, 2010. We saw 6 mega floods. We've seen the price of food go up something like 80% because we've had crop failures around the world. And the UN just told us we put a record amount of carbon into the atmosphere this year, despite the recession and everything else. So on the list of things I'm worried about, those are the things.
We're out of time. Thank you all very much. Bill McKibben, founder of the 350.org campaign, Darren Samuelson at Politico, Richard Rood at the University of Michigan, Anthony Lazarowitz at Yale, and Elizabeth Colbert with The New Yorker magazine. Many thanks to all of you for being with us today. Turkey has reelected Prime Minister Recep Erdogan, but he'll need a political coalition to write a new constitution. We'll hear about possible changes in the secular state now ruled by an Islamic party. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Prime Minister Erdogan is wildly popular among Turkey's poor and the Muslim middle class, but secular Turks in urban centers worry about his party, the AKP, and what it could mean for the country. Mark Champion is in Istanbul. He's reporting for the Wall Street Journal, covered the election. And Mark Champion, thank you very much for being on our program.
Not at all. Delighted to be here.
There is going to be a divided parliament, and Erdogan's party does not have sufficient votes to change the constitution all by itself. How important is that?
Well, it is important. When we say a divided parliament, they will have an absolute majority. They simply won't have the supermajority that they would need in order to just rewrite the constitution all on their own. So they're about 4 votes short of doing that. They need 4 or 5 votes to do it. They can probably find them, the fact that they didn't quite get there was kind of heartening for people who, for investors and also for, you know, people on the other side, generally people who think that what would be healthy for Turkey is that this new constitution should be written as a matter of consensus rather than just by one party. But it still remains really to be seen. They may be able to scrabble those, you know, 4 or 5 votes from, you know, independents and other corners of the parliament and not really have to go with consensus. Erdogan, in his acceptance speech, he made a big deal about saying we're going to try harder to embrace others. We're going to try harder to work with others. But it really, there's a good deal of skepticism about whether that will happen.
If it doesn't happen, what are the alternatives? How and what sort of constitution might emerge?
Well, one of the odd things about this election campaign was that the reason it was so hard fought, given that everybody knew he was going to win, was in order to make sure that he would get more in his case or less in the case of the opposition, that his party would get, you know, less or more than 330 seats in order to be able to do this. And yet the Constitution was actually not spoken about by either side in any detail. They simply said, we want to make one. They all said, we want a very sort of liberal constitution, a democratic constitution. So that the honest answer is, we simply don't know. We don't know exactly what he's going to do. He insists that it will be secular and democratic, and we'll see. But obviously there's nervousness on the side of the opposition. The key thing that he has said that he does want, and which worries a lot of people, is that he says he wants to change Turkey from a parliamentary republic into a presidential one. And that would create a much more centralized form of government. And the worry is that in this part of the world, you don't get a U.S.-style presidency, you get a Russian-style presidency. So that's the big concern.
What about the secular tradition in Turkey? To what extent has it been eroded by religion in the political system? We're not talking about the possibility of Turkey ending up looking like Iran, I presume.
No, we're not. I mean, every once in a while that is said by various people, but it's very, very hard to make any kind of serious case for that. One of the interesting things in this campaign compared to the 2 previous ones that Erdogan and his party have won was that the opposition really didn't try to win votes by warning and threatening that if you vote this guy in, we will end up with an Islamic Republic. They did try and do that in 2007 and 2002, and it didn't work. And they didn't try this time. And I think that's partly because while there are lots of, you know, people who are concerned and there are lots of accusations that they are sort of slowly eroding different corners of the secular state, it's been very difficult to prove anything, which I guess in the end says that they've actually done very little in order to erode the secular nature of the state.
Very quickly, why does Turkey need to change the constitution?
Well, they had this constitution was written in 1982, right after a military coup, and it was written basically by a bunch of generals, and it's not a very liberal constitution. It has some very odd aspects to it. You know, for example, several clauses of it are supposed to be unchangeable under any circumstances, which is a you know, very odd proposition if you speak to any constitutional lawyer. So it does. There's a general consensus that it needs to be replaced, but there's just nervousness about who gets
okay.
to replace it.
Mark Champion, Istanbul bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Total, thank you.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Andrea Brody and Karen Radziner. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.